The following podcast contains strong language and frank conversations about topics that some listeners may find upsetting.
I did not accept my HIV diagnosis at the beginning. I literally ran marathons to run away from it.
You have this conversation in your head a million and one times by yourself, and I bet the answer you're expecting from your young person in your mind is always a negative one.
Welcome to Positive Advice, a podcast by Cheeva. Cheeva is a charity that supports children, young people, and young adults living with HIV to become healthier, happier, and more in control of their own futures. We're all about amplifying those young voices and putting them at the center of the discourse on HIV. I'm Eli Fitzgerald, your host for the series. I'm a young trans man living with HIV and a member of the Positively Spoken team. Oral history is vital in sharing our story, indeed any story, to help gain an understanding and to learn from our past. In honour of oral tradition, this podcast will use archived audio collected from Cheeva's Positively Spoken project, being delivered in partnership with the British Library and funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund. We will give experts and other contributors an opportunity to hear the lived experiences of these young people and how they see the world. Alongside the guest experts, I'll be joined in each episode by Cheeva's CEO, Amanda Ely. Amanda, thank you for joining us. Could you please, in about 60 seconds, tell us who you are and what you do.
Thank you, Eli, and I'm delighted to be here. I'm really excited about this podcast series. So I'm Amanda Ely, and I'm the CEO of Cheeva. And Cheeva is a national charity that works to enhance the well-being of children, young people and young adults who've grown up living with HIV. And we have projects that run across the UK supporting young people and working very closely with clinic teams.
In this first episode, we'll be looking at the role family plays in young people's HIV journey, for good and bad. And here to discuss this complex issue with us is Fungi Morrell, a HIV expert who has worked with numerous charities internationally over the years. Fungi, thank you for joining us. Could you please tell us a bit more about your connections to the world of HIV?
Thank you very much, Eli. So I have been living with HIV for over 2 decades, and it has become my passion to do a lot of research and mentoring of other people living with HIV, and especially young mothers that are starting a journey into pregnancy, baby and beyond. I believe that everybody should have access to mental health services. And if they don't have them because of their lived experience with HIV, then it is our responsibility to provide peer support for those people.
So Fungi, today we're talking about family. Could I ask you why family is so important to you?
I am a very proud mom of 2 beautiful girls, and I don't think I could navigate life without them. And I would like to think that they think that they could navigate life without me. So family remains a very critical and important part of, especially when there's HIV within the family, to just have that support throughout the whole family, because that essentially becomes your main community.
Throughout this series, we will be hearing firsthand accounts of the topics we covered from young people we caught up with at the 24th International AIDS Conference in Montreal last year, as well as from the young people who worked with Cheeva who've added their own stories into the mix. To start us off on the topic of family, this is James, a gay man from Myanmar who chose not to tell his family that he's living with HIV.
Nobody knows about my case, especially in my home. My father, my mother, and my siblings, they don't know about my case. Only my close friends, they knew about it.
Wow. So do they know where you are now here at AIDS conference?
Yes.
How do you explain that?
I just told them I got a scholarship to attend the conference in Canada. They are really happy for me. You mean about my parents?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you're at an AIDS conference, is that because...
It's okay, because in my country, I'm a medical doctor who is taking care of patients with people living with HIV too.
Right.
So I have my parents knew that I'm very familiar with the cases and I'm very interested in HIV, because I really help people with HIV too in my country. I help them in some way or another. For example, I support them in financially or emotionally or in some help. So my parents knew that I was very enthusiastic about and very interested in cases about HIV. So it's okay.
Wow, it's a big secret to carry. Is that difficult for you to keep that? What would worry you most about them finding out?
Since when I was young, I was pretty worried because I don't want to hurt them telling that I have HIV, because my father, especially my father, he is very traumatized by the death of his younger brother, who also suffered from HIV and dead. So I didn't want to hurt him. So when I was young, I was really afraid that they will find out about my case. But when I am getting older, and I don't try to hide from them. I just, for example, like I have to take the medicine daily, right? When I was young, I always hide the medicine from them, like in my closet, under my bed or something like that. Now, I just let it stay on my table, and they find out and ask me, where are these? And these are medicine I have to take every day because of my health. That is it. And they don't ask me for any other questions. Yeah.
Listening to that, it seems very much that James feels quite uncomfortable sharing that he's living with HIV to his family because he thinks they wouldn't understand. And Funga, I'm going to ask you, what are the common barriers to talking about HIV within families?
I think I'm going to answer that in sort of a two-pronged method. We have to start looking initially at the root of transmission. I know this is a really, really uncomfortable topic, especially if it's vertical transmission. There lies the barrier of stigma from the birthing parent, stigma, shame, fear of rejection from the child. So instead of talking and addressing HIV within the family, they tend to just sweep it under the carpet, hoping that maybe it'll go away, maybe the child will understand. Then as it grows bigger and bigger within that family, that conversation will become much, much heavier to then address it at a later stage in life. The second one, if you acquired HIV like I did through sex, then there's a fear of if your family knows that, then you become this person who is immoral, that you didn't look after yourself. You acquired it because you wanted to. That again, then becomes just that root of fear of even beginning to talk about your HIV status. Just fear of being rejected, fear of being put in a corner, fear of people bringing back the stigma from the 1980s right at the beginning of the epidemic. That stops conversations happening within the family units.
100%. You're definitely onto something there with sort of that stigma, in a sense of whether that's self-stigma or the stigma and the misconceptions people still believe what happened, like you said, in the 80s and 90s to even now, and how that holds in different generations. So Funga, I'm gonna ask you a question around the differences you experience and how your children experience HIV. Could you expand a bit on those differences?
The differences, I think when I was comfortable, I began to live very, very openly with HIV. I do not hide my medication. We speak very honestly and openly about HIV in my household. So I think that is a bonus for me. It's not saying that this is the reality for everyone. It's very, very different within each household, how much they want to share with their children, how much they don't want to share with their children. My youngest is 9. She kind of like understands HIV yet in a way that I never thought she would. Her first concern was fear of me dying and leaving her as a young child. And when I explained that the medicine that I'm taking is going to keep me going for a very long time, she's become quite comfortable with it. So I think for me, I'm quite lucky that I've always been quite open and honest with my children about my own HIV status.
Amanda, I'm going to ask you a question on any differences you experience whilst sort of working with young people living with HIV, and whether there are some significant differences you see on, say, a household like Fungi's that's very open and honest, and those where HIV is treated very much as the sort of elephant in the room not spoken about.
That distinction is a really important one to think about, because what Fungi describes is, you know, providing this open space where essentially if children have got worries and concerns and things they don't understand, they can talk about them, they can raise it, because she's set up a space to enable that to happen. And I think that when we see that, you know, for some really complicated and understandable reasons, not all families feel able to do that, then those worries and those concerns can sit in children's heads as they grow up. And, you know, that can be really difficult.
How do we break some of these barriers down in that sort of worries of, you know, parents dying or HIV not being spoken about at home? What would your tips be on breaking down some of those barriers of keeping it such a big secret?
If there is a child living with HIV within the household, there is going to be levels of anxiety, levels of worry, levels of fear and everything that comes with it. I would say one of the tips is to make sure that as the birthing parent, it is not your sole responsibility to have that initial conversation, but you need to be available to have follow-up conversations. If you cannot have that initial conversation, trust some people that your young person can speak to, preferably people that are going through that same journey, so that they've got that peer support from a nurturing person that is known to the family, that is bringing the evidence, the science, the realities, breaking down all the horrible things that they may find on the internet, just breaking that down and taking it into bite sizes that a child can understand for their age, a language that is appropriate for their age. And from the parent sort of perspective, from my perspective, it is about reassuring children that, yes, I've got this tiny little virus. It's about sort of making sure that the virus becomes the tiny little thing that mummy or daddy or whatever you call it, they're going to be here as long as they take that medication. And if there's a young person already living with HIV in the household and it becomes sort of a parent and a child living with HIV, one thing that I would recommend is taking your medication together. It becomes just something that we're in this together, especially when they're younger. Taking it together normalizes that experience of living with HIV within the household before they go looking for answers outside the household, where they'll probably become stigmatized.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's so invaluable, that opportunity to model to a young child, this is how we stay well, this is how we look after our health, this is how we support each other, this is how we make taking medicine a normal part of our daily life. Modeling that to a young child is incredibly important, and it's such a wonderful thing if a parent is able to offer that. And we do see these patterns very clearly. You know, the child who by the time they're in mid to late adolescence is having a very difficult time with their medicine, is maybe not taking their medicine anymore, because we do see this unfortunately quite a lot, you know, it can just become too much. We'll very often see some of those patterns in the wider family. You know, if you've got a parent who's equally found it really difficult to take their medicines, or medicines aren't something that's open in the home, they're hidden away, maybe other people in the household don't know, you know, we can see sometimes that this becomes something that the child can kind of replicate. And it's just because it can be, you know, it can be so complicated in families if there are sort of people in the household who don't know and how that's managed. So that description of this kind of daily taking your meds with your parent, I think, can be such a wonderful support for children growing up. And it really normalises their medicine taking.
Fungai, you sort of mentioned about not turning to the internet in a sense when it comes to young people trying to find out more about HIV or families trying to find out more about HIV. Could you give us some advice on where families should go?
Well, families should go to more trusted sources where preferably you can actually talk to a person face-to-face. That's the first thing. So either the healthcare professionals, if there's a service that has been provided for a family, my biggest recommendation is to find and lean on services like Chiba, where they're going to provide holistic support for the entire family. So it's not just for the one person that is living with HIV. It's almost like a family. It's looked at as a family unit. I would say, rather than going onto the internet, just avoid that. Try to find peer support groups that look at the whole household, and try, even when they look at the household and then think, okay, do you know what? The best service for a teenager in this house living with HIV is actually this service. They can then signpost each member of the family to something that is going to speak to them, meet them where they are, so that when they do come back together as a family, they have all this rich information that they can share to make the experiences of living with HIV much more manageable, much more realistic to what they are going through.
Let's move on to our second conversation now, captured in Montreal. We spoke to Barbara about her relationship with her family.
So when they took me back home, I still felt unwanted. So I became so frustrated, I felt sick. Now when I felt sick, I lost a lot of weight, like I was badly off. But the only time I was taken to hospital was when my sister fell sick. So when they were taking her to hospital, they also took me along. But now, it's like they couldn't see like what really was wrong with me, so they just bought a few tablets and took me home. The next time, I think I almost fainted at home. And when they took me to hospital, my stepmom told the nurses to test me for pregnancy. Because for her, she knows I'm sleeping around, so I could be pregnant. So when she finds out I'm not pregnant, she just goes away without anything. And they didn't tell me they had tested me for pregnancy. But the other person we had gone with, he's like, you know what, Barbara, I won't lie to you. We asked the doctors to test you for pregnancy. That's what I was told. I got so disappointed and I said, you know what? I'm going to do everything I possibly can to recover, and I look for a man and I get pregnant. So I did that exactly and I recovered. I looked for a boyfriend. I got pregnant. So of course, after getting pregnant, you realize you're doing a mistake, but it's too late, you're already pregnant. So I got pregnant and I went to hospital. So when I went to hospital, that's when I tested HIV positive. So now I find out I'm HIV positive. I'm supposed to start medicine immediately. I'm like, who do I talk to? So I went to tell my dad, and I started from where it started with his brothers, what they did to me. And he refused to believe me. So I didn't see any point in telling him I was HIV positive and I was pregnant. I just told him, Daddy, I want to leave home. So I left home. I had nowhere to go. I just went on the streets. So I'm on the street again, this time pregnant on ARVs.
How old are you at this point?
I think I'm 20. Yeah, I'm 20.
So there was obviously quite a lot in that clip with a lot of different issues. But I think a standout challenge that Barbara was facing was this feeling of abandonment from her family. And Fungai, I was going to ask, what can someone do when they're finding themselves feeling abandoned by their family? Where can they turn for the support they need?
You know, that story just made me really, really sad. That there's a young person who is tested for pregnancy without their consent at the beginning, which is just wrong. And then being abandoned by the family that she ends up on the street. I mean, I'm just going to speak in the context of the UK, really. I think there are child support services that can support a person that finds themselves being abandoned. It is really tricky because, again, some of the services, there's still quite a lot of stigma and discrimination within healthcare services, within other services, that will be very difficult to navigate. Again, I would say to speak to healthcare professionals, to be open and honest about what's going on, especially if you're finding yourself on the streets with your ARVs. Those are like your sort of your little diamonds every day. You can't risk those being stolen, being spoiled. So I think it's just reaching out to services that you know you're going to be safe. You're a young woman living with HIV, you're pregnant. So if there is a woman's refuge close by, then that's where I would start with. But again, it's about finding services that are appropriate for what it is you're going through. And then trying to also educate the family that's abandoning you about the realities of HIV and teenage pregnancies and everything else that's going on. Because I always think that if you can re-engage with family, that would be the safest place, if it is a safe environment, for you to go back to.
Definitely, definitely. And I think there's definitely something to be said about sort of having that support within a family, and then maybe also having a sort of chosen family outside of, you know, biological family, and people you can look up to and talk to as a safety net. And I think Chiva has done a really good job at facilitating those chosen families for young people through the support camps and just for a range of activities. And Amanda, I was wondering, what else is there that Chiva could do to help a young person living with HIV who's going through such a traumatic experience?
It was really difficult to listen to Barbara's experiences, and she does clearly live in some incredibly adverse circumstances. Fortunately, just for context, fortunately, Barbara's now doing really well and she runs this amazing charity, etc. And I had the privilege of sort of, you're getting the excerpts from these stories, and I have the privilege of knowing some of the great outcomes. So I think that's always very reassuring to know that when people have been through these really horrifically adverse circumstances, actually, that things can turn around and people's lives can take a much better course. So
that's very reassuring.
Great to hear that about Barbara. So I think that this comes back to understanding that supporting health is not simply addressing the impacts of a disease, is it? It's not just treating a disease and keeping illness at bay. Supporting health means really thinking holistically about what people need to live well, to have a good quality of life, to have good emotional well-being, to have good psychological well-being and social well-being. And all of these things, you know, are connected. We can't separate out physical health from mental health, etc. We know all this. So it's so important to be really holistic. And I think we have to be very realistic sometimes. You know, if somebody is homeless, if somebody has been rejected by members of their family, and we do hear these sorts of stories very sadly, you know, not too frequently, thankfully, but we do hear them, you know, of stories of people being rejected, finding themselves on their own completely. And in those circumstances, you do have to sometimes put HIV and taking your medicine aside. That is the reality. And we have to say, well, look, how can we get this person to a safe space where they have their basic needs, where they have shelter, where they have food, where they feel safe, and where somebody can start to support them? And then, you know, at that point, once things are stable, you might be able to then start working with someone to help rebuild, managing their health-related needs. So it's very difficult. And I think this is where an organisation like Chiva will try very hard to reach a young person who may be in some very adverse circumstances. But it's about where you connect with all the other agencies that are out there and that have duties to support people. So it's about working collaboratively, you know, with the clinic team, with social services, with other voluntary sector providers, and working together to meet a whole array of needs that somebody might have, you know, and then together collectively you can often be really effective. But it's about a package of support that you can help put in place for somebody. And it's really important to sort of approach your holistic work in that way, I think.
Fungi, I was wondering how, or if you had anything to add onto the sort of needs of young people living with HIV, especially those sort of more complex needs where multiple issues are arising.
That's a very, very good question, because we do see that in a lot of young people, especially when they have come from family units where HIV is not spoken about. And then they get to a point where they suddenly think, oh my goodness, it's almost like a light bulb moment. Oh my goodness. And they stop taking medication, that the household is really turmoil, and they're not doing very well at school, or they've been excluded. So there becomes this whole range of complex needs and issues. And like what Amanda said, it almost takes a village then to try to find how to bring this young person back into the fold by not putting HIV as the priority, but putting their life in general as the priority, to sort of say, what is it that you want before you then get sage, say, listen, you'll need to take your medication again. And when you start talking about HIV, then engaging them in peer support services through Chiva and other voluntary organizations, that then becomes a very, very beneficial moment where they can see that there's somebody else that is living with this condition. It's not just me. I'm not the only one in the world. I felt like that when I was first diagnosed. I thought I was the only one in the world living with HIV, although I knew I wasn't, but my mind just told me that. I could only imagine what it would do to a young person. They would feel that their world has collapsed. They've got all these other complex needs. So it's about addressing the complex needs one at a time with the support of the young person, for them to prioritize the things that matter to them the most.
Definitely. I definitely connect quite a lot to that, where if I'm, you know, going through a bad time or whatever, I very much put HIV aside. I'm like, I'm not bothering with this, which sounds awful, but it's too much. It's too much all at once. And to have someone go, yeah, you've got to manage your HIV at all times. And I think it is true that us young people, when things get too much, HIV does get pushed aside, but that doesn't mean we don't still need that support, that ongoing holistic support from, you know, places like Chiva. So yeah,
I think we also have to recognize that there's some young people that come with comorbidities.
Yes.
So sometimes HIV is not their priority when they're going through other health conditions.
Absolutely. Now, as I've said before, Chiva is all about bringing young people to the center of the conversation on HIV. And Ruth McCoe, who is also a team member on Positively Spoken, joins us now to share the thoughts of a recent Chiva workshop, where a group of young people listened to and gave their thoughts on these clips. What was the key feeling from that group around the topic of family and HIV?
So we found that in this workshop, that the thing that was spoken about most was just the clip that was from James and how he spoke about how he kept his pills on his table, and that was very normal for him. And actually, the young people said that they really liked that, the fact that the normalization of having pills wasn't keeping it and hidden away or keeping them under the bed, but actually that they were on the table for him to see. And I think that simple thing of having a pill bottle on a table can normalize a conversation. And I think that links very well to what Barbara was talking about how she didn't have a family to be open with, and actually how something so simple as having medication on a table or speaking to your children about what your medication means or what it does is such an important thing. And having an honest family is something that can really help in a family that has HIV in it. And for my first question, I'm going to point this to you, Fungi. You mentioned that you have children, and as someone who has started their own family, how has your experience of family changed throughout the years?
I think it's just changed throughout the years. I did not accept my HIV diagnosis at the beginning. I literally ran marathons to run away from it, although I took my medication. So it was really, really difficult for me to accept my own diagnosis. But when I did, over the years, I felt more calm with myself. I started sort of just being kinder to myself. I think through this, I started being kinder, was more patient with my children. There wasn't this anxiety of them finding my medication or anything like that. That's when I decided to just be very open with them and my medication out where they would see it, because I could no longer carry that burden when I didn't go to the shopping center and buy HIV. It just happened to me. So I think through the years, through learning, through a lot of therapy, through peer support, I have grown. And I think I see the growth in my girls as well. They just see that mum's doing all right, mum's growing. And I'd like to think that I'm a good role model to both my children.
Definitely a good role model.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Another question, and I'll point this to you, Amanda. Some of the young people from Chiva commented that HIV impacts more than just themselves, in particular the relationship with their parents or caregivers. So my question to you is, how does Chiva approach working with parents and caregivers?
Thank you, Ruth. And I think that's a really important question. And it's something that we've started to think about much more in recent years. And I think because Chiva started as a children's organisation, and we now work with young adults as well, but when we first started out, it was very much a children's organisation. We provide services for children, so we really focused on the children, right, which is all good. And so we would do lots of projects with children, for example, our summer camps, which really focused on helping them understand their HIV better, helping them feel more confident about themselves, helping them feel like, you know, they had really good aspirations for their future. They built a peer network, and we thought, this model works, it's really great, the children are clearly benefiting from this. And then they'd go home from a camp, say, and when they came back to the next event, describe having not spoken about HIV since the last time they came to an activity. And so we started thinking a little bit more about this pattern of, like, you can create spaces and you can try to sort of nourish children, if you like, with support and information and a peer network. But if you don't work with the wider family, you're actually not going to help, you know, other people around that child who provide such an important network of support as well. You're not kind of bringing them along with you. And we also were hearing from young people that they were sharing some of what they'd learned often at camp, say, about HIV updates, new information, treatment developments, etc., with their families. And very often they might be the only person in that family who was accessing wider support. So we started to think about how could we kind of improve how we worked here, really, and started to develop more programs that parents could be involved with. So we have now, in recent years, we've run an annual conference for the whole family to come together with that real aim of sort of helping families start to have conversations with each other. So using a sort of supported space to help that happen, but also providing lots of updated information.
And fun.
And I think, you know, sometimes it's just like with all sorts of things in life, sometimes families do need like a kind of outside person, if you like, coming in to help shift stuff, because we all have our patterns, we all have our ways of communicating, and we can all get stuck in ruts where some things just don't get spoken about. And I remember this came up, Ruth, when we were doing the workshop with the young people listening to the clips. There was this idea of a family culture, do you remember, where young people were saying, like, sometimes you're just not in a family where stuff gets talked about, and it's not just HIV. You could be in a family where just stuff doesn't get talked about. And so if it is a bit like that in your family for whatever reason, it can be helpful sometimes if someone else can come in and help mediate and help support some of those conversations that can feel uncomfortable, that can feel difficult, and it can be a difficult starting point. You know, how do I even start this conversation about HIV? What are they going to ask me? I mean, it'd be great to sort of maybe hear from Fungi about some tips there for parents who might, maybe they're listening, and carers of children who have HIV, who are really worried about how to even start that conversation, you know, maybe telling a child that they have HIV. How do you even begin that? You know, what's helpful to think about?
Yes, I think it is a very worrying conversation, because you have this conversation in your head a million and one times by yourself, and I bet the answer you're expecting from your young person in your mind is always a negative one. So to then get out of your own headspace and have that conversation can be really, really daunting for a parent. My advice is to do it when you are feeling calmer as a parent, and to almost take the child out of the normal environment. When we have difficult conversations to have in my household, I call them love bomb days, where we go out, go for a walk, we go to the park, whatever. And I don't have my phone. I'm fully available. And we have a conversation. No matter how difficult it is, we've got to have to start that conversation. And then we don't have to finish the conversation there. It's also for the parent to then be prepared that you don't just tell your young person that they're living with HIV and think that that is the end of that conversation. That is just the beginning of the conversation. There'll be a lot more conversations that will come up. But again, this is where peer support and Jiva can play a very active role in making sure that the conversations carry on in a very, in a positive way. A child is going to be, sometimes they're going to be angry. Why do I have this virus? Why didn't you test? Why didn't you think about me? There are always going to be these questions and anger that may or may not come up. When that comes up, it's a matter of saying, okay, listen, I'm going to call somebody, if that's okay with you, to help us navigate this conversation a little bit more. But the person you call has to be trusted by the young person. You can't just bring in a random person without the young person's consent, without the young person knowing who they are and what benefit they're going to bring to that conversation. But my biggest thing is to just do it. But think about the young person first. Don't wait too long, because they will go and search on the internet and then find out things that are going to be even more difficult to address.
You made that point there about don't wait too long. And what do you think are the benefits of talking to children at a younger age? You know, like, I don't know, a 7-year-old, say, for example. What do you think is beneficial about starting those conversations when children are younger?
When you start the conversations when children are younger, I would say even from 5, when they can begin to understand that they're taking medication, normalizing it, that becomes a normal thing that they do every day. They have to take medication. And I think it's about naming that virus as soon as possible.
but also telling the young person about all the stigma and discrimination that can come around with that. But if you start telling them at a younger age, it's almost like a drip, drip, drip effect. Of as they get older, their questions will become grown-up-ish questions as well, in accordance with their age. You've already set that foundation at a young age. You've empowered them with knowledge that some of their peers may not even have access to at that age. So it is really, really important to start really early, naming it and making sure that there is support within the household and outside, that they're not going to feel lonely with this thing. Because I always think that if a child goes to somebody and says, oh, I take a pill every day, but I don't know what it's for, they're going to come up with all sorts of conclusions.
Well, thanks everyone for contributing. As you've heard throughout the podcast, we're digging through the stories of people living with HIV, hearing their firsthand accounts of their experiences. And here to give us some perspective on this is Dr. Wendy Rickard, who's an oral historian who has worked with Chiva on the Positively Spoken project. So what exactly is the Positively Spoken project, and where can we hear it?
Okay, Positively Spoken is a project so named by the people who have taken part in it. It is an oral history project. It is about collecting broadcast quality recordings from people who grew up with HIV, preserving them in an archive forever within the British Library in an unedited state. So they will be there, and the word we like to use is in perpetuity. So they will be there forever for the future. And nobody's going to meddle with them in their original form. So the idea is that people give their instructions as to how they would like those recordings to be looked after, and the British Library will abide by those instructions. And my experience of the British Library is that they have been absolutely brilliant about observing people's desires and wishes. The project is funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund, so we're very grateful to them. And the British Library itself, I should probably say one or two things about them. They have been collecting oral history over 250 years, and they have a massive, I think the largest collection in the world of sound recordings on a huge range of topics. So these voices that we are recording for the Positively Spoken project lie alongside and equal to all of those recordings that are already in there. So we're about capturing the personal experiences and opinions of key witnesses, if you like, to what's happened around HIV while you're growing up. We have particular emphasis on the idea of shared authority, of participation, of setting and your own boundaries about what we record and how we record it.
And what are you hoping this podcast series will add to that?
I think one of the things I've learned from a long coexistence with various collections in the British Library archive already is that it's about not knowing. It's about opening up to possibilities for what can happen in the future by spreading the word about this project. There have already been a number of existing HIV podcasts in the UK and TV features that have been really brilliant. So this contributes to challenging predictable assumptions about who and what matters. And we feel our project is really important, as you know, because children growing up with HIV were one of the most hidden groups on the planet. Everyone was told to be quiet, shut up, don't tell anyone. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to find out, if you were from somewhere outside of one of those groups and you wanted to know about them, it's a very difficult way in because of very understandable things about safeguarding and protecting people. But at the same time, that can also take people's voices away. So this has been a very delicate project to work out how can we give people a voice? How can we preserve those voices sensitively to the families and the context in which people are recording them? How can we make it possible for people with very difficult stories and extraordinary contexts into their lives to put their stories somewhere safely, to feel confident that they're going to be looked after, and to make sure that those voices stand alongside the politicians, the religious leaders, the policymakers, and all the rest of it, and that they may have unforeseen benefits in the future? So there were other collections, for example, we recorded, I was a small part of a collection around haemophilia and HIV, and those life histories have actually been used in the recent public inquiry that has taken place around haemophilia. So very exciting possibilities for oral history as a living history tool that is a force to be tapped and unleashed and mobilised in the future.
So I'm going to ask the same question to Amanda and what you are hoping this podcast series will add to the Positively Spoken project.
I'm hoping that it will enable us to amplify the stories that are at the heart of this project, to reach audiences that we may not be reaching via our website, where the clips of the stories we've recorded are held and available for people to listen to. So it's really about getting beyond the scope of the people that already know about Chiva and where our website is, and reaching people who may not even know that this is something they're interested in. And hopefully by them listening and engaging with this series, it might spark some interest, some intrigue, and perhaps a few people will then want to learn and understand a little bit more. Because I think coming back to all of this is about people understanding HIV better, myths being dispelled, stereotypes being dispelled, and just creating a kind of social situation where people living with HIV, growing up with HIV, young people can have a little bit of an easier time feeling that it's okay to tell anyone you want to tell or not about your HIV and not be so concerned about people's responses.
Thanks everyone for listening to Positive Advice for Chiva. I'm Eli Fitzgerald, and thanks to Fungi Morel, as well as Amanda Ely, Wendy Ricard, and Ruth Mukko for joining me today. In our next episode, we'll be looking at the impact living with HIV has on our mental health and adding to our oral history. In the meantime, if you want to learn more about Chiva, or if you want to access clips and updates from the Positively Spoken project, then head to chiva.org.uk and follow the links there. Positive Advice is a TBI Media production for Chiva.